I get to read our scripture this morning. My name is Shelley McCarron. It is Mark 4, 36 through 41, and the title is Jesus Calms a Storm. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in a boat just as he was. And other boats were with him. And the great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?"
Thanks, Shelley. Well, we are on the last of our names that come from Isaiah chapter 9. As a reminder, these are names that were given of this coming king, this one who was promised, whose name, whose identity, whose character was wrapped up in him being a wonderful counselor, a mighty God, everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. And it's that last name in particular that would have struck the hearts of the original audience. The Israelites, the Jewish people at this time, were living in a moment that did not feel peaceful. There was the looming threat of war, of invasion coming in. The people were so separated from their God, they had turned away from him, that there was just so much chaos that it was described as darkness around them. This world that was broken did not feel very peaceful. And so this king was promised, this ruler who would come, and he would bring peace. Now, there's a variety of ways that we can think of how a king might bring about peace. I mean, war was threatened. A king could help put an end to war. There was the strife and struggles that the people were going through. It was a difficult time to live, and the king could end that. There's the economic uncertainty that can make us feel ill at ease, and a good king could lead through those things. But we say all of these names point towards the one who did come, this ruler who comes as Jesus. And when we think about the way that Jesus brings peace, well, it's different. It's different from those things. And that's something that Jesus himself even acknowledges. We read a little bit from John chapter 14 last week as we were looking at how Jesus promises to not leave us as orphans. He is a father to us. When that very same chapter, he describes what his peace is like. This is John 14, verse 27. He says, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid." Jesus says, "I have come to give peace," to his disciples here, to the world, to us who still wait his return. He has given us peace, but he quickly says, it's not the peace that we're typically used to. It's not the peace that comes from military might. It's not the peace that comes from relationships never going through difficulty. It's not the peace that comes from economic stability. His peace is something entirely different. His peace is something entirely better. And what I think he's getting to with this is, so often when we think about peace, we are talking about something no longer being there. When we use the word peace, we say something that is not there anymore. Peace means that there is not hardship. Peace means there is not war. Peace means that there is not uncertainty and difficulty that we're going through. Often when we describe something as peaceful, we are speaking more to what is missing than what is actually there. And the peace that Jesus brings is not merely the removal of things. Now, certainly, that is one of the ways that Jesus does bring peace. We can think of the variety of ways that Jesus brings peace by taking something away. One of the main ways that he makes peace is between us and God. That the description of this world that's so broken, as we turn away from God, well, it leaves us in a place where we're not just on a negative footing with God, we're called enemies of God. That we are made to be with him, we are made to live in the way he has for us, and in avoiding that and turning towards other deities, other things, ourselves, Well, we make it a vision right there that puts us on the opposite side of God. And what Jesus comes to do is he takes away that hostility. He takes away this opposition. He takes this away so that there could be peace between us and God. We read about this in Colossians chapter 1. It says this in verse 19. It says, "For in him, Jesus, in him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross." See, what Jesus comes is he lives this perfect life. He dies this death he did not deserve to give us a life that we do not deserve. And in so doing, he takes us who were once enemies of God and makes peace by what he accomplishes. Makes peace between us and God, taking away the hostility that was there. He also makes peace between us possible, taking away the conflict that people otherwise seem to have regularly. That we talked about this last week when looking at Ephesians chapter 2, that Jesus makes it possible for those of us who claim him, who follow Jesus, to not be in opposition to one another. Because we have a shared family bond, the shared foundation, which is Jesus, and that's stronger than anything else. What that means is that you and I don't need to be enemies if we happen to vote differently. You and I don't have to be enemies if we arrive to church and we think things should be done differently than how we see each other operating. You and I don't need to be enemies of one another if we happen to have different beliefs. I mean, we have a world around us that says those who believe differently than you are your enemy. It is us versus them. But with Jesus, we do not have to do that. We do not have to be pitted against each other if we have different understandings of things because of what is shared, because of what is brought between us, and that is Jesus himself as our foundation. Jesus comes to break down hostility between each other, taking away this enemy relationship that we might otherwise have by himself. So there's a variety of ways that Jesus brings peace by removing something. But he does more than that, something greater than that. But maybe this is where we get to a question. How is that possible? And when we read through Isaiah 9, it's describing the situation for the Israelites, what this Prince of Peace was going to come and do, and it's the taking away of wars, the putting of end of conflicts, all that pains, all that's hard is no longer existing. And when we see those very same things still exist to this day, these things that would otherwise rob us of our peace, how can we say the Prince of Peace has come if they are still here? This is where I want to help us get a bigger understanding of how Jesus is the Prince of Peace. Not just as one who takes things away, but one who gives so much more. It's not in what he removes that makes him the Prince of Peace, but what he puts within us that makes peace possible. If you were to ask a Christian, what is one Hebrew word that you know? The one shared answer that you might get would be this word, shalom. Shalom is a word that many people have heard before. Maybe it's because whenever there's a sermon on the topic of peace, the person talking about it tends to go, but it means more than peace. Shalom doesn't just mean peace. Maybe we've heard that spiel before. Maybe we're familiar with the word. So what I want to do today is, exactly that. Because shalom means, and you're not going to believe this is crazy, it means more than just peace. It's not just a saying that peace is what is brought in. Instead, it's this idea of wholeness, of completion, of lacking nothing. When the word shalom is used in the Old Testament, which was written in Hebrew, it is speaking as everything being the way it's supposed to be. There's so much positivity put into that. It's not just speaking of what's not there anymore, but what is brought in. And what's brought in is perfection. And so when Jesus is talked about as the Prince of Shalom, the Prince of Peace, it's not just speaking of the things that would be taken away, but what he brings, what he gives to his people, this perfection, this completion, this lacking of nothing that's found in himself. But shalom as well is a bigger picture than just peace, because typically when we think of peace, we think of the spots in our life that do not feel very peaceful. Maybe the relationships that we wish were not marked by conflict. maybe the difficulties that we've been going through that make us not feel at peace. And Shalom does capture that, but it's a much bigger idea. It's often thinking of the community, of how people as a whole are missing something. And in Shalom, in peace, it is to where all of us together are lacking of nothing. And to that end, Shalom is always global in trajectory. Even this promise of Isaiah 9 that's given to a particular people group at a particular time, the end goal of peace, the end goal of Shalom, the promise of it is that all this world will be made perfect. All will be lacking of nothing. Jesus is the Prince of Peace, not merely for what he takes away, but what he gives. And he gives shalom, perfection, completion, all that we need within him, lacking of nothing. To get to that, I want to focus on an image of Jesus. Often at Christmas, there's attention given to Jesus sleeping as a baby. And that's fair enough. I think it's a wonderful image. It speaks of the humility that he has. It shows that he is fully human, 100% human. And even though, as we read in Colossians 1, the fullness of God dwells within him, he is fully God. This picture of God becoming such a vulnerable thing, like a child sleeping, shows the humility that he does to join in with us. It's a beautiful picture. So it's one that we focus on quite a bit at Christmas. We sing songs that say, "Little Lord Jesus asleep on the hay." We sing, "Sleep in heavenly peace." There's even song titles that just capture this idea. There's "Sleep, Little Baby Jesus." I have to say this one slowly. "Little Jesus, sweetly sleep." And then "Sleep, Baby Jesus." And that may sound like I just said the same song title three times in a row, but those are legitimately three different songs that are focusing on Jesus as a baby sleeping. But what I think is one of the greatest pictures of how Jesus is the Prince of Peace is a different time that he's sleeping. Is a different time that he is asleep. One that doesn't capture his humility, but instead captures his power. And that is what enables peace. We had Mark chapter 4 read for us earlier, and just let me give a little bit of background to it. So in this situation, Jesus has spent the whole day, the entire day, teaching and speaking to this crowd of people. But now he's traveling to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, this lake that's in the region, and he is exhausted. All day long he's been teaching. And so during this journey across the Sea of Galilee, he falls asleep. Pick up the story in Mark chapter 4. Verse 36. It said, "And leaving the crowd, they took Jesus with them into the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling." I want to draw attention to that adjective that's given to us. It says that this is a great windstorm. This is some extraordinary storm that begins to come. And to the point that the disciples are terrified. The boat is filling. It's taking on water. They are scared. And we might say, yeah, that's understandable. A storm like this would have been terrifying to go through. That's the natural response in that moment. We're missing a couple details with that, though. One would be that the majority of Jesus' followers, these who are with him in the boat, were fishermen, who spent their whole lives fishing and, in fact, sailing on this very sea that they're traveling across right now. And so for them to be caught off guard by this, for them to be taken unaware would be remarkable. Their entire livelihood, their ability to provide for their families would have come down to their ability to predict a storm and navigate it well. Otherwise, if they can't do that, they're going to go hungry. They're not going to provide for their family. And so for these fishermen who are used to sailing on this very sea to be so caught off guard shows that there is something incredible going on with the storm. We also have a little random detail. Mark is sparse on details. So when we're given them, that should make us take notice. It says there are other boats with him. This means nobody saw this coming. This has come out of nowhere. So this great storm, this massive storm comes unlike anything that they've ever seen before, and they're unable to sail well. They're unable to navigate the boat during this. And if anybody would have been able to sail through this, it would have been these very fishermen who spent their whole life on this very sea, and they say, we can't do anything. And if they can't do anything to save them, well, then nobody can. And throughout this entire time, Jesus is asleep. Now, that is remarkable. Ships are not notoriously stable on water in the best of times, let alone when this great storm is coming. He stays asleep. Well, he doesn't stay asleep for long. The disciples wake him up and say, do you not care that we are perishing? Don't you see what's going on? Why aren't you panicked when we're panicked? Why are you so immoved by what's going on around us? I mean, even if they're not expecting Jesus to do anything about the storm, and we have no indication to say that they would be, there's still that question of, why aren't you concerned when I am so concerned? Maybe that's a question that we've asked before, many times, to others, to God. But Jesus is able to do something about it. Verse 39. It says, and he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Jesus wakes up, he stands, and he says, peace. And where there was once this great windstorm, now, the same adjective is used, there is this great calm. Before, it was this mega storm, and now it's been replaced with this mega calm. That's not telling us things went back to usual. That's not saying that things went back to how it was before the storm came. You know, a normal amount of chop in the water, light breeze in the air. No, when it says that there is a great calm, this is an extraordinary return. The water would be completely still. No breeze, no wind whatsoever. This silence would hang over that moment. I'm sure the only thing that you would have been able to hear is the still elevated heart rates of the disciples who have not yet come down from their panic. See, when Jesus says to the storm, peace, shalom, the Greek translation would have been from this. He isn't just saying that the storm stopped, that the wind dissipated, but he brought true shalom here. Perfection. So much stillness, so much quiet, completion. Not just the removal of something that was scary, but wholeness and certainty and stability put instead. Shalom. From that, he then turns to his disciples and says, why are you afraid? And that could sound harsh. There was a scary storm just a little bit ago. It was like nothing we'd ever seen. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't save ourselves. But that's not what Jesus is asking. Fear, so often when it's talked about in the Bible, is not the normal response to the scariness of the world. It's not speaking against the uncertainty and the panic that could come from that. It's not going through difficult circumstances and criticizing the normal response that many of us have, which is looking at scary things and going, ah! Instead, fear in the Bible is the certainty that God is not good, the belief that God will not act, the understanding that I have been left here on my own. Fear in the Bible is not the sense of scariness that we feel in difficult circumstances, but the finality that comes from saying God will not and cannot do anything. It is in a sense then, not being at peace. One of the most often asked questions throughout the Bible is this question of how long? How long will circumstances continue to be so difficult? How long will things be so hard around us? How long, God, will you continue to not act? How long will I need to go through this? The question of how long is asked something like 53 times throughout the Bible. And yet it's overshadowed by what is probably the most common command throughout the Bible. Do not be afraid. Fear not. It's commanded of the people. Not saying don't act like things are scary, but don't have that finality that nags at us to say God won't do anything. That finality that says peace is not possible. See, when Jesus asked this question, why are you so afraid? He's not making nothing of the storm. It was real. It was frightening to people who would have otherwise known how to sail through it. But he's able to say, fear not, in response to that. Not because he promises circumstances will always be rosy. You'll never have to go through anything like that ever again. But because of who was in the boat with them. Because the Prince of Peace had come. That even a Jesus who was asleep, even a Jesus who seems unmoved by what is moving us, who is calm when things around us are not, even a Jesus who looks powerless is still the one, the only one who can give peace. And he does so in a way that's better because it's not just the promise of removing things, but instead, the peace that he offers is better and greater because it's peace that is possible even when things are not removed. Now, I really want us to get this. This is so important that we understand this, especially at this time of year. So often, when we ask for a peace, it is often in the language of God, take away this conflict. God, take away this illness. God, take away this warring that's going on around us, either literally or figuratively. God, take this away so I can be at peace. And we are invited to pray those prayers. Pray them boldly. But what is promised, the picture that's given to us as Jesus, this Prince of Peace, this promise of Jesus who gives peace, not like this world does, but a peace that is real and lasting and better because it's not just the removal of something. It's not just the taking away something that can come back later. It's not just the removal of one thing and then something new comes and floods in and takes away our peace. Instead, we can say we have peace because Jesus is with us. We have peace because he has made things perfect. He has given me completion and perfection. I am lacking of nothing because he has given it to me. So I am unmoved. I am unrattled. Nothing is robbing me of my peace because I know this Prince of Peace is with me. And I know that is so easy to say from up here. That is so easy to affirm those together while at church, while everybody's smiling or at least pretending to be. I know that that is easy to say when we are not in the midst of a storm. What about when we do not feel that way? What about when we are looking at the scariness of the circumstances around us to try to not give in to that finality of fear? How do we still understand this when we are in the midst of conflict? Well, I think the best way that I could kind of try to show that this is truly peace that's possible is beginning with a little bit of a confession. And that is, I am not a particularly handy person. That there is little that I can do when something is broken other than just perhaps maybe make it more broken. That I can't put together much that is not the way that it's supposed to be. And so this is where I'm really grateful that other people are gifted in ways that I'm not. So I think of Spencer Stump. Spencer Stump is an incredibly handy person. If you don't know, he is fantastic at making sure this church is set up so we can come in and have it be a church home. He's fantastic at fixing things that are broken here. It is a great gifting, and we're so grateful to have him here at church. But I know that if something was broken in my home, I could probably call up Spencer and say, hey, can you help me with this? He could come over, show him the problem, and then you could say, yeah, I can fix that. Here's what I'm going to do, and go step by step of all the things he's going to be doing. It goes in one ear, exactly out the other one. But then I leave him to it. He's there fixing it. And maybe you and I have a conversation while that's going on. He's like, oh, what's I heard this was broken. What's Spencer doing to fix it? I don't know. No, but like, what are the steps he's doing to make it work? I really have no idea. He explained it to me, but I just didn't really understand it. Then how do you know it's going to be fixed? Well, I know Spencer. I know his character. I know his competency. I know his care for me. And so I can be at peace in that moment, because I know that he is doing this. Or I think about when I was a kid, that I'm so grateful, I know not every household was like this, but I never needed to worry about food being put on the table. And it was a great mercy for that. Now, I have no idea what went into making that happen. I was a kid. I was wrapped up in my own world. I was watching TV or doing homework or probably watching TV. But I was doing my own thing, and my dad would be in the kitchen. He was the primary cook that we had for our family, and he would be doing something. I have no idea what he was doing in there. Something to do with knives, maybe a pan. I'm not sure. I didn't understand the mechanics of it. But without fail, even though I did not know what he was doing to make it possible, I knew right around 6 p.m. I would hear the phrase, "Dinner's ready." See, even if we can't make sense of the pieces, even if we don't understand how the pieces fit together, we don't know how a particular circumstance is going to be worked out. We don't know all that goes into it. We can still say with confidence, "I am at peace because I know God is working. I know God is in control. I know God is powerful. I know God's character." So that even when we can't make sense of the pieces, it does not change who our peace is. You're going to be okay. How? I have no idea. But you don't need to feel tossed around even while in a storm. You don't need to be flooded with despair, even if you can't see any good news around you. Not because you can see the way out, but you can know that there is one. We know of God's care and character and competency, and so we can say, "I don't need to be afraid." Yeah, things are scary, but they don't need to rob me of my peace. Because the Prince of Peace is with you. And I think that perspective, if we can recognize that, even if our circumstances do not change, our peace is not tied to the removal of things, but instead what's been given to us by Jesus. When that is our position, when that is the foundation that we stand upon, I think that perspective is contagious. I was listening to a podcast this week. It came out a couple weeks ago, but finally got around to doing it. And just like everything, it's a year in review. So looking back on 2025. And the way that they were doing it is these Christian leaders kind of walking through what were some of the major headlines that kind of defined this year globally. And it was just bummer after bummer after bummer. Just looking at these major news headlines that were so hard. So there was the rise of crime globally. There's AI and the resulting job loss panic that has come from that. There's debt, which is defining this world globally. It was just bad headline after bad headline after bad headline. And then when they get to the end, try to put some positivity on it, they said, "Here's what I think can make Christianity distinct in 2026. That in this world that has no peace, nothing that I can point to and say, this is why I can press on. This is why I can keep going. What will make Christianity distinct is to be people of hope. Not blind to what is going on around us. Not ignoring the real pains and real sorrows and real storms, but being able to say, no matter what, even if these are not taken away, I, in the midst of it all, can have peace. Because I can point to this one who is working in all things. What will make Christianity distinct in a hopeless world is the hope that we have." One detail I left off about this podcast. These Christian leaders who were doing the year in review, they're Australian. And the episode that I listened to was put out just a couple days before Bondi Beach. And the question that popped in my head is, do you think the answer changes? I mean, just a few days before, they would get the worst headline they would have to go through. A few days before, their country would be devastated by just needless violence and despair and hardship. They would be grieving just a few days after that. Does that change this optimism, the spin that we put on it? I mean, by no means. Even though they had not yet realized how difficult things would be, it doesn't change the answer. This world needs hope. It needs something that it can long for, something that it can look forward to and say that we can put certainty into it. It's not, man, I wish things would be different. There's nothing that does. Wishful thinking is not going to change the circumstances either. But being able to say, I know things will be different. I know what the future will entail. I know that things will work out. Nothing in this world offers us that. Nothing gives us that certainty that we so desperately crave. Everything else around us says there's going to be more storms. There's going to be more hardship. There's going to be more pain. There's going to be more suffering. And what we as Christians can say is, yeah, that's probably right. But we're going to make it. We're going to be okay. Peace is possible because the Prince of Peace has come. And even for those things that we still long for the removal of things that are so difficult, while we still say, please take these away, how long will they still be here for? We can know that things will work out because just as the Prince of Peace has come, the Prince of Peace is coming back. And that is what enables us to have peace now. That is what enables us to live lives of hope in a hopeless world that we can then point other people to. And being able to come alongside of them and say, I don't know how things are going to work out for you, but I know how things are going to work out for you.